All right. Last week, we saw how the church got started. And we looked in three places in Acts, four places, I'm sorry, where we traced the history of the beginning of the church. Now, we said in Acts 2, Pentecost was the very beginning of the church, and it started with the Jews, right? And the what we see in at Pentecost. And then the next place, we went to Acts 8, and we saw that now the church went out to the Samaritans. And the apostles went to the Samaritans. They were brought into the church. And we said that was, you know, Luke put this in there intentionally to show that you had the Jews first, and then you had the Samaritans being folded into the church. And then we saw in Acts 10 the first Gentile convert with Cornelius. And so now we see Gentiles in there. And then I said there was this weird little passage in Acts 19 of these guys that were followers of John the Baptist, and they ran into some of the guys, and they said, well, we don't get this whole Holy Spirit thing. And they said, well, let's find out what's going on. And they found out in the story there in Acts 19 that these guys were what we would call Old Testament believers. They were believers as Jews in the Old Testament. And this particular story, I said, Luke included in there to show that believers under the old program, under the law, are now included. You know, they just happen to be around with the transition into this new period of the church. And so we see the growth of the church starting with the Jews, moving Samaritans, Gentiles, and then a little bit of a dispensational cleanup that we need to do. And so the church is now established. And so this week we're going to take a look at what was going on up to... We're going to get right up to the destruction of Jerusalem and pretty much the death of the last apostle, which I generally believe is John. Next week we'll start looking at the growth of the post-apostolic church, the period of time of the church after the last apostle died. Remember that during this period of time, from Pentecost to about 90 or so A.D., you still had living apostles, and you had prophets, and you had folks who were giving ongoing revelation as the church is being formed. So the dynamic is going to be different as we move into, you know, up into the second, third, and fourth century. There we now will have the church operating, but now, you know, you can't just go over and talk to Peter or James or one of the guys. Now you have to, the church has a different dynamic going on. So, but we're still in the period of time here where you have apostles and that the church is still in its beginning stages. So, we see the inclusion of all these different groups last week. So now we have the church, which is this entity that is made up of everybody, and everybody's equal in the church. And Paul says that over and over and over again. There's no Jew or Greek or slave or free or male or female. But while that's the ideal, in reality, and I think this question came up last week. I think you brought this up. In reality, what happened is you've got basically two groups of folks in the church. The church is spreading, but it's still fairly contained. And you have two groups. You have Jewish believers and you have Gentile believers. And we have a clash of these cultures. And you see in the practice of the early church this kind of thing going on, where we sort of have folks still in that mode of Jewish religious practice, even though they're in the church. We have Gentiles now coming in who aren't familiar or don't practice the Jewish religious practice, coming in and participating. And so we see this interesting dynamic that's happening. If we go to Acts here, and there are basically four types of religious practice going on in the church at this time. And remember, we're talking, if we assume that Jesus died and rose 33 to 35, well, anywhere from 30 to 35, depending on who dates it, we're now looking at probably 5-10 years after this. We're into the 40s, late 40s. Coming into the 50s, we find that some of the early writings are starting to happen. So this is reflecting a period of probably 10 to 20 years after the death and resurrection of Christ, after the ascension. So it's still very, very early. You know, if you think the church's been around for 2,000 years, give or take 50 or 60, that's a very short period of time. Okay, so we're seeing this. If you go to Acts 2. Where we go? Okay, Acts 2. In 2 verse 42. They're talking about the early believers. Acts chapter 2 verse 42. They were devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to breaking of the bread and to prayer. We'll come back to that breaking of the bread in a minute. Wonders, miraculous signs. All who believed were together. They held everything in common. And then here, 2:46. Every day they continued to gather together by common consent in the temple courts. So we see that one of the things that the Jewish believers, the early church members, are doing is they're still going to the temple. Okay. Now it's interesting the way that's phrased. Your translations may be slightly different than what I just read. Some just say they were going to the temple. The way that's structured, it really talking about the temple courts. Not, it's implying that they weren't necessarily going in there and offering, you know, the kind of sacrifices on the altar as if they were, you know, full-fledged card-carrying good Jewish boys in the first century. But they were still attracted to the temple. That was their religious. That was the hub. That was the religious center for Jews in and around Jerusalem, and certainly for these new. Jewish believers who were part of the church. So the first thing we see is that we still have temple activity going on. We don't have a lot of detail about what that encompassed. In my personal opinion, which you're going to get a lot in this class, by the way, and this personal opinion does not reflect the views of Hadavar or the ICC or any of its subsidiary agents. This is all my views on this stuff. Kind of the way humans are is that you have a tendency to stay with your patterns in things that are hugely important to you. You know, we all shop at the same grocery store most of the time. You know, we send our kids to the same college we went to, those kind of things. Religious stuff is hugely important in people's lives, and so we have a tendency to repeat those same patterns. And so it would not strike me as strange at all for a Jewish believer who is part of the church to still go to the temple and even offer temple sacrifice. We know that, and we'll see in a little while, that there was an issue of, do Gentile believers have to do what being a Jew meant with temple and diet and physical requirements and whatnot. So I don't think it would be strange to think that you had the occasional church member who was Jewish going down to the temple and offering a grain sacrifice or a couple of doves here and there. And it's clear that they'd still go to the temple, although I think the Acts 2:46 passage is more about the general court areas of the temple, but they're still there. The other thing that we find out is they're still going to synagogue. Remember in first century, if you were a Jew in the first century, and you guys know this because Hadavar teaches this very well, that you had the temple practice, but you also had synagogue, right? The temple was where the priests and everybody were, and the synagogues were all the Pharisees were, and it was more of, it was more like our Protestant church services almost, in a way. And so we find that the Christians are still heading to synagogue. And now this is well, it's stated directly, although this isn't technically a synagogue here. In 8, we're still in Acts. We go to Acts chapter 8. And let's see, where is it here? Okay. Where is it? I'll get it here in a second. Sorry about that. This pause you're hearing on the CD or online, if you're listening, is me trying to find the trying to find my reference point. When they go to okay, here we go. When they're over in Ephesus, they are looking for They're looking for, on the Sabbath, they're looking for the place where everybody goes to pray, which would be the synagogue. And they don't find one. They have to go down by the river because apparently there weren't enough enough men to actually get a synagogue going. Here we go, 16. That's what I wanted. All right. Acts 16. Okay. Here we go. Starting in 1611, at the arrival at Philippi, we put out to sea from Troas, sailed straight course next day to Neapolis, from there to Philippi, which is a leading city of the district of Macedonia, a Roman colony. We stayed in the city for some days, 1613 here in Book of Acts. On the Sabbath day, we went outside the city gate to the side of the river where we thought there would be a place of prayer, and we sat down and began to speak to the women who had assembled there, a woman named Lydia, a dealer in purple cloth. So what we find is that on the Sabbath, they're still going to essentially what they believe is going to be a synagogue. I'm not sure I remember. There's a certain amount of men that you had to have to form a synagogue, a certain core group. Does 10? Okay, 10. And apparently there weren't enough here because all you got were the gals. Now we all know from being around churches long enough that if you want to get anything going, you have to have the women's ministry really do it because the guys never show up. So it's biblical. So they go down here and they're expecting to find a synagogue, but they're still looking for a place to go pray on the Sabbath. So we see that here's two examples now of continued Jewish religious practice even by members of the church. Okay, so we still see this going on. Christianity has not separated from Judaism. It's still in the sort of warp and woof of that. Now, another thing that we see, and we have to actually go out of the Book of Acts. I know that the class is titled Book of Acts and Church History, but we have to expand a little bit here. And you need to go into Corinthians for the next two. The other two things that you find church people doing then, besides going to the temple and besides going to the synagogue, is you find the practice of the Lord's table, of communion. And you also find a sort of a look at what an early church service looked like. Now, there's debate on to whether these things occurred simultaneously or different times. But if we go over into 1 Corinthians... we find Paul talking about this. 1 Corinthians 11. I have this translation of my Bible that I really like, and it's falling apart on me, and it makes it really tough to flip around. Because all the pages fall out. 11, starting in 17, Paul starts talking about the Lord's Supper. And it's interesting because he's condemning them for incorrectly getting together and practicing communion. It doesn't really tell us how to do it, but it reflects that they were doing this. He says, in 11:17 in 1 Corinthians, now in giving the following instruction, I do not praise you because you come together not for better but for worse. When you come together as a church, there are divisions among you. And now when you come together at the same place, it's not in order to eat the Lord's Supper. For when it's time to eat, everyone takes his own supper. One is hungry, another becomes drunk. He goes on in 23 through 26 to reference back to the Passover meal that Jesus had with the disciples. And then he goes on to give specific statements about how when they come together for the Lord's table, they're supposed to act. Now this is really interesting because what we find here is fascinating. When Jesus and the disciples had the Passover meal on the Thursday before he died, I always love it when people say, well, that was the first communion. And if you're in a high church thing, they say, well, that's the first Holy Communion, right? And that wasn't. What Jesus did with the disciples was a Passover Seder. It was not Christian communion. The church hadn't started yet. There was nothing about that meal that looked like communion. Okay, it was a Passover, and it was rich in symbolism and in content, and it was where Christ identified himself as Messiah and the whole nine yards. But it wasn't the church's practice of the Lord's Supper. Okay, it was a Passover Seder. Now, what's fascinating to me, and here's an example of how God gives us what we need, not necessarily what we want in Scripture, is you have these great stories of the Passover Seder with Jesus and the disciples. And then the next thing we get is this description of a sort of drunken party at a church function. And we don't get anything in between to tell us how one turned into the other. Okay? Scripture doesn't give us, well, now here's what you do. We're going to take these parts of Passover and we're going to convert them over into the church language, and we're going to now have this new thing that, you know, instead of being done on Passover, we're going to do this on Sunday, and we're all going to get together in a certain... And we don't have any of those sort of rubrics in the text. What we get is a description of that this stuff is happening, but that it's highly dysfunctional. And Paul has to correct that. You guys are doing this wrong. When you bring food to this meal, those of you that have a lot of food, you're letting other people go hungry. You're not sharing. When you come to this meal, some folks are getting drunk. So we know it's not a Baptist church. We get this picture that this stuff is going on, but we don't see how it got there. But there's an acceptance that this is common church practice now. Now, I'm okay with that. I, for a long time in my life, got real upset that I couldn't figure out all the answers, and I couldn't go to a chapter and verse in the Bible to find these sort of transitions. And now I'm really okay with it. It shows that what the church is doing, we still do today, the Lord's table. It was done in the first century, and God doesn't tell us how it got from Passover to that, but he just tells us that it did. So that's the third thing the church is doing. Church members, Jewish believers, are going to temple. They're going to synagogue. We know that Gentiles and Jewish believers are coming together at the celebration of the Lord's table. The fourth thing that we find is this description also in 1 Corinthians. See, if I was smart, I would have kept my thumb in that, and then I wouldn't have to reopen this. Over in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 26, now we get the description of what's going on in a first century church service. 14:26, what should you do then, brothers and sisters, when you come together? Each one has a song, a lesson, a revelation, a tongue, an interpretation. Let all these things be done for the strengthening of the church. And he goes on to talk about how, you know, if there is prophecy or tongues or something, you have to have an interpretation and whatnot. So we see that what's happening is within the Christian community, there in the first century, there are these defined times when the church meets, and there appears to be although it doesn't give us the actual order of service, there appears to be a process involved that includes some singing, some teaching, and revelation and prophecy. Remember that in the first century, we still have active revelation and prophecy going on within the church. So, it's while that's something that I would view as not being normative for today, in the first century, it's still happening. Okay, prophecy still existed. The apostles, the prophets were there to give revelation to grow the church. So we see four things happening in the early church out of Acts and out of Corinthians. A temple practice, synagogue, communion, and these church services. Now, within all of this, we start to get this problem of Jews and Gentiles bumping into each other. And a lot of the Jewish believers want the Gentiles to become Jews in order to be a part of the church. And a lot of the Gentiles are saying, nah, I don't think we have to do that. You guys are just being legalistic. And so this all comes to a head, and they end up sending Paul back to Jerusalem. And in Acts 15, we see that we have the first ever church council that's going to decide this issue of do you have to become a Jew to be a member of the church? Okay, and everybody who was anybody was there, for this meeting. It's sort of a list of the main authority in the church in that day. Acts 15, chapter or verse 1. The problem was that unless you're they came down from Judea, began to teach brothers, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Paul and Barnabas had a major debate with them. They went on back to Jerusalem, and the apostles and the elders, and they decided they were going to work through this and figure it out. And this was really the first thing they had to rule on. How do you deal with Jewish believers and Gentile believers all in the same church? And so after everybody given their opinion and whatnot, they come down to realize that there's basically a couple of things you have to do. And they write a letter that's going to go back out to, that Paul and Barnabas are going to take back out to the folks who are questioning this. And in this letter, we have the teaching of the first church council there at Jerusalem. In 1523, they sent this letter with them. From the apostles and elders, your brothers, to the Gentile brothers and sisters in Antioch, Syria, Cilicia, greetings. Since we've heard that some have gone out from among us with no orders from us and have confused you, upsetting your minds by what they said. Notice what's happening here. They're recognizing that there's clear authority in the church, and the authority in the church rested at that time with the apostles and the elders, the prophets, okay? That these other folks who were teaching that you had to be Jewish to be Christian, they did not recognize that they had authority to do that. Okay, so there's an established authority. I know that for a lot of folks, especially in the American church, issues of authority are sticking points within local churches, and they rub people kind of the wrong way. But there has always been an authoritarian structure within the church, and clearly in the first century it rested with the apostles. That was clear, and this is saying that they've unanimously decided that's important. It was decided by everybody. This wasn't just James saying, "Okay, guys, this is how it's going to be," or Paul saying, "This is what I want." Unanimously decided to choose men to send you along with our dear friends Barnabas and Paul, who have risked their lives in the name. Therefore, we're sending. They'll tell you these things in verse 28. For it seemed best to the Holy Spirit and to us not to place any greater burden on you than these necessary rules. They want to see the church not be a place that had all these rules like the oral law and the Torah had for the Jews, where you had hugely complex structures in place. They didn't want to place any greater burden, and so they asked him to do a couple of things. Abstain from meat that had been sacrificed to idols, from blood and what has been strangled, and from sexual immorality. Now, that's interesting. This is my take on this. Some folks hold a slightly different opinion. These are not issues of salvation. They're not saying that you have to do these things or you're not saved or you're not a member of the church. I believe that clearly they know they're speaking to a primarily Gentile community, Gentile believers, and what they're asking is that these are the things that would be highly offensive and go against the sensibilities of the Jewish believers, because these are all issues that relate to Jewish law. So these things that if a Gentile believer did them in a church community, it could give great offense to a Jewish believer who was there. So what they're basically asking is, here's the compromise. You guys don't have to keep the dietary laws. You don't have to be circumcised. But here's what we need you to do. You need to don't take food that's sacrificed to idols. Remember Paul said that was an issue that you could, with the weaker brother argument? I think that's the same thing in play here. Sexual immorality, everybody was against that, Jew and Gentile alike. That should be no problem. Although, remember, Gentiles had a little bit looser moral code on a lot of this stuff, because part of what the Jews viewed as sexually immoral for the Gentiles was normal social interaction. The Hellenistic practices of the day that would be offensive to a good Orthodox Jews, to a Gentile who grew up in a Hellenistic culture, it's like, I mean, that's just what we do. I mean, it's almost like an argument against, ladies have to wear dresses versus pants kind of thing, you know. And so I think we're looking at that ones in there, not because everybody thought, well, it can be sexually immoral if you want to, but that there were certain things within the Hellenistic culture that were very offensive within the Jewish culture. So this essentially was the church's way of saying, okay, now we need to get everybody working together here. We need to make this as homogeneous a unit as possible. This is what we need. We need the Gentiles to just do a couple of things so they're not giving offense to their Jewish brothers within the church, and then everything should work fairly smoothly. Okay? So that was the big battle within the early church, was this idea of what do we do? How do we define ourselves? There's still some overlap. They're still going to temple. They're still going to synagogue. You've got a problem with Hellenistic culture and Jewish culture. Remember, this was a problem within Judaism too. You know, you had a Hellenistic Jews who essentially wanted to abandon Jewish practice. I mean, this goes back to the intertestamental period with these kind of issues. So it's not uncommon that we would see this in the church. That's what was going on inside the church. Outside the church, looking at the church, folks still thought that the church was just a sect of Judaism, okay? That these guys were really all Jews, okay? The Romans viewed them as just another, you know, sort of fraction of Judaism in the first century. And they really didn't make, at this point, this strong distinction between the church and Jews. You know, to the Romans, they were just a bunch of folks that they kind of had to sit on down there in the Palestine area to keep them from, you know, causing a lot of trouble. And remember, for Rome, peace was the greatest thing. That was the most important. But a lot of stuff was going on that would start to affect the church, okay? There were things culturally that were happening that was going to impact everybody, whether you're a Jewish believer or a Gentile believer. So once they got the inner dynamic in the church handled between a Jew and Gentile, we start seeing things happen here in the first century, mid to late first century, that was really going to put the church on a path to really breaking out on its own. Okay, some of it is political. Some of it is some of it is related to just what was going on in the region at the time. If we go back to the book of Acts, and we start in, let's go to 11. There was a big famine in Palestine that started. Chapter 11, verse 27. At that time, some prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. One of them, named Agabus, got up and predicted by the Spirit that a severe famine was about to come over the whole inhabited world. This took place during the reign of Claudius. So the disciples, each in accordance with his financial ability, decided to send relief to the brothers living in Judea. They did so, sending their financial aid to the elders by Barnabas and Saul. So we see that one of the things that starts to happen is we've got a famine. When you have things that are occurring within the natural world, they have a direct impact on the economy of a region as well as the political structure of a region. So when you start to have a famine, folks are going to be more prone to get a little out of hand, right? Because you got to have food. And it's going to concern the political leadership to say, whoa, we got a famine going on down here. That's going to make the people a little uneasy. And again, for Rome, peace was the most important thing. So they say, what are we going to do in this area? There's a famine. We know that's going to start being a problem. Next thing you have is a leadership change in Rome. Over in Acts 12. We have Herod. I don't want to read the whole story. 20. Now Herod was having an angry quarrel with the people of Tyre and Sidon. They joined together, presenting themselves before him, and after convincing Blastus, the king's personal assistant, to help them, they asked for peace because their country food supply was provided by the king's country. On the day determined in advance, Herod put on his royal robes, sat down on the judgment seat, and made a speech to them. But the crowd began to shout, "The voice of a god and not of a man." Immediately, An angel of the Lord struck Herod down because he did not give glory to God, and he was eaten by worms and died. You just don't go against God, you know? Even if you're Herod, you'll get eaten by worms and die. So there's political change, regime change, as we call it nowadays, right? So we've got a famine, we've got regime change. Now, what goes on even more then is Rome is starting to get really upset with the Jews. Again, they're not making distinction at this point between Jews and Christians. And it could be that some of this is being brought on by Christian activity. But if we go over to Acts chapter 18, verse 1, after this, Paul departed from Athens and went to Corinth. He found there a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife because Claudius had ordered all the Jews to depart from Rome. Claudius threw all the Jews out of Rome. Okay? So now you have Rome starting to get really upset with the Jews for a variety of reasons. So now we start to see that you've got a famine in the Palestine area. You've got political upheaval related to Jews and Christians, and we have a change of leadership with the Roman authority. You have Claudius up in Rome saying, you know, that's it, everybody out of the pool, throwing all the Jews out of Rome. So now what we have is we've got these things starting to build. Now here, this is probably around the late 40s, early 50s, I guess. And you know that all of this is pointing to 70 AD, where we get the destruction of the temple. And so we start to see this stuff happening. Now, it's interesting that it starts to really ramp up Rome versus Jewish folks, okay? There are skirmishes and battles between Jewish zealots and Roman soldiers. Sometimes the zealots win and they kill off some Romans. Sometimes the Romans win and they kill off some zealots. So we're starting to see this ramp up. There's a great story, Josephus' Jewish Wars, about this guy, Cumanus. To me, this is just one of these great stories. I mean, it's great now. It wouldn't have been great had you been living at the time. But Josephus is writing about a period of time where there's this tension between the Jews and the Romans here in around Jerusalem. And correct. Yeah, this is part of the ramp up to what's going to happen. Okay, let me find it here. Here we go. The people had assembled in Jerusalem for the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now, these are Josephus' words. As I said last week, I hate to do a class where I say, let's do chapter 2 in the book, and then I read chapter 2 in the book to you, because you could do that. You don't need me. But I like to bring in, especially when we're studying history, actual documents that reflect what was going on. Josephus was writing history at the time. So Josephus says, the people had assembled in Jerusalem for the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the Roman cohort stood on guard over the temple colonnade, armed men always being on duty at the feast to forestall any rioting by the vast crowds. Rome knew that it could get out of hand. So they would post all these Roman soldiers up on the roof, up around the temple, to make sure that as people came in on the big feasts, there wasn't a problem, right? This happened all the time. But they had a problem this time, okay? Josephus continues, one of the soldiers pulled up his garment and bent over indecently, turning his backside towards the Jews and making a noise as indecent as his attitude. So, you guys get the picture here. This infuriated the whole crowd, who noisily appealed to Cumanus to punish the soldier, while the less restrained of the young men and the naturally tumultuous section of the people rushed into battle and, picking up stones, hurled them at the soldiers. So, you got a soldier who makes an indecent action towards the crowd who are down at the temple. He's up on the roof. All the hot-headed young Jewish boys immediately pick up rocks and start chucking them at the soldiers. It gets ugly. Now, this is... Sometimes we have to take Josephus not too literally. Josephus said the result of that was that there was this mass sort of everybody got out of the temple because they thought, oh, heck, all, you know, there's going to be a bit. Somebody rushed out, and he says that 30,000 people were crushed to death, Jews. Whether that number is accurate or a little high, we don't know. But essentially what happened was this Roman soldier getting a little out of line caused this big riot. They started chucking rocks at him. It is amazing that you see this pattern still repeated even today on the news when you see the stuff going on the West Bank. And so here's the problem. Now, Comanus, he decided that they needed to sort of really get this place in line. And Josephus goes on to tell about how a bunch of the Jewish zealots, who were still pretty fired up about this, grabbed a week or two later, grabbed a Roman servant who happened to be a servant to Caesar's household on the road, and robbed him and beat him up pretty bad. Comanus found out about this and said, that's absolutely unacceptable. You can't attack a member of Caesar's household. And so he sent a group of Roman troops into the local village to root out and find out the guys that did this. Well, part of the problem is when they went into the village to destroy it and to find out the people, the Jewish guys that had killed this, the Roman soldiers got a little overheated, and they actually went into the synagogue and grabbed the scroll and brought it out and desecrated it in front of the people. They tore it in half, and they made disparaging remarks about the Jews. And this was hugely unacceptable to the Jews. So now they go back to Comanus and say, listen, okay, we killed your guy, but you just defiled our sacred Torah out of ours. And so Comanus, who again, in Rome, keeping the peace was the most important thing, he went ahead and grabbed the Roman soldier that did that and had him beheaded out in front of the people to show that, okay, look it, we'll call it even at this point. But you can see that this kind of stuff going on is just not going to make relationships good between Rome and the Jews, okay? Now, the Jewish Christians, the church members that were in around Jerusalem, see all this happening, realize that it's really going to get ugly, and so they actually remove the Christian church out of Jerusalem around this time. They go to this place called Pella. You sort of go to the Jordan and make a big right, and you go over in this town. And it's primarily, interestingly enough, a Gentile area. And the Jews in around Jerusalem who are so upset with Rome are starting to get upset with the Jewish believers and the Gentile believers, the Christians. So that's one of the reasons why they had to leave, because they were being persecuted by the Jews. Because the Jews think of them as this heretical sect, right? They go over, the Jewish church kind of moves out of Jerusalem, goes over to Pella. They start getting persecuted by the Gentiles, okay? Because the Romans and everybody else is starting to see a separation somewhat between the Jews and the Christians, but they realize the Christians are just as bad in their view as the Jews, okay? And so while the deal with Rome and Jerusalem is getting ugly, it's starting to get ugly between Rome and the early Christian church as well, and we start to see persecution. Nero was really the primary guy that used to go after the Christians. Now, Nero is an interesting guy. He started out, everybody really liked him. I mean, most people now think of Nero as terrible and that he was a bad emperor. But he started out, his first 3, 4, 5 years, everybody thought he was doing a pretty good job. And then he started to go a little bit nuts. There was a big fire in Rome, and folks, and I don't think this is true. I don't think that Nero started the fire. A lot of the documentation said he wasn't around, that it actually was started by like some oily rags in a warehouse kind of thing. But a lot of folks blame Nero for the fire. And the fire in Rome burned for a week and destroyed a huge part of Rome. And there were all these stories about how Nero did this intentionally so he could rebuild Rome in his own image. And they tell these stories about how he was up on the rooftops while this fire was happening, and he was dressed in a toga playing a lyre and reciting Greek poetry, you know, the story of the Trojan War and whatnot. And so you get this really bad publicity for Nero. So Nero decides, I don't want to bear the burden of this, so he decides that the Christians are the perfect people to blame the fire in Rome on. Right? Jews were already gone. They'd been kicked out. So Nero decides he's going to blame the fire in Rome on the Christians. And it's one of our earliest references that we have of Christianity coming in a non-biblical text. Okay? Because remember, everything that we have so far has been biblical text. This is one of the earliest points where we find a non-biblical text talking about Christians, and specifically talking about Jesus. Tacitus, who was a Roman historian, who actually didn't like Nero all that much. This, by the way, is that was Josephus' Jewish Wars. This is a book, and it's about 50,000th revision here, New Testament Background Selected Documents by Barrett. Excellent book for your library. It's a really good primary source for first century documents about the church. And there's a copies of Tacitus. He wrote this piece called the Annals, and it's a history of Rome. And in this particular section, he's talking about Nero. And again, this is stuff that was written. This is very close to the time. This is written in antiquity. So this is not contemporary literature here. Consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite torture on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. So right off the bat, the Christians were hated for their abominations. We'll talk about what those are later on. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, that's a Latinized way of saying Christ, right? So Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out, not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. So, you know, just like we say about L.A., New York, and Las Vegas, you know, if it's ugly, it's going to show up there, right? It's interesting. He's talking about that this guy, Christus, suffered the ultimate penalty. He was killed, references to Pontius Pilate. And then he says this, a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out, not only in Judea, but in Rome. Well, that's the story that Christ didn't die, he rose from the dead. That's the mischievous superstition he's talking about here. And so he says, accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty, then upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much the crime of firing the city as of hatred against mankind. So the Christians were arrested and killed not really on a theological ground, or not on an actual criminal ground of putting fire to the city. It was on nobody liked them. You know, the emperor didn't like them. They were hated of their hatred against mankind. And he goes on to talk about how every sort of mockery was added to their death. Nero was not a nice guy, and he killed them in very brutal, torturing, terrible manner. And Tacitus talks about that a little bit. Another guy who was writing about this period of time, Suetonius, makes another reference to this. Again, here's another non-biblical reference to the church. Punishment was inflicted on the Christians, a class of men given to a new and mischievous superstition. We find now Sulpicius Severus, another Roman historian, is writing about the same time. He says, in the meantime, the number of Christians being now very large, it happened that Rome was destroyed by fire while Nero was stationed at Antium. Talks about him not being able to escape. He therefore turned the accusations against the Christians, and the most cruel tortures were accordingly inflicted upon the innocent. In this way, cruelty first began to be manifested against Christians. Afterwards, too, their religion was prohibited by laws which were enacted, and by edicts openly set forth, it was proclaimed unlawful to be a Christian. At that time, Paul and Peter were condemned to death, the former being beheaded with a sword while Peter suffered crucifixion. So we find that Rome starts to persecute Christians on their own. Yeah. You didn't miss it because I didn't talk about it.
Okay.
Christians were viewed as very aberrant in a social structure in early Rome, in first century Rome, in the way that Jews were viewed as aberrant socially. Christians and Jews had in common that they worshiped this one God, which was just completely ridiculous to Romans. Romans worshipped a variety of gods. Romans worshipped the emperor. That was part of how social stability was maintained. It would be kind of like this is a rough parallel here. If you had someone stand up in this country to say, I don't believe in the President of the United States. I am not going to follow the laws that the President of the United States gives out. I'm just not going to do that. Well, we would say, that's un-American. I mean, you know, whether you like who's in office or not, it's the President, and as Americans, we honor our government. We would look at that person who says, I don't believe in the American government as aberrant within the society. Well, if you're a Roman in the first century, you look at Jews and Christians who say, we don't honor Caesar, we don't honor the Roman government, you view them as aberrant in society. There were a lot of rumors about Christians that, and these are malicious rumors, they were part of how this hatred was fueled, that Christians practiced incense, incest, that they actually were cannibals, that they murdered infanticide, they murdered babies. That they did these wild sort of occultic rituals when they got together. Now this is interesting that a Roman would be offended by that, because in Rome, the practice of child abandonment and infanticide was huge. There was actually this is one of the great things about the Christian Church. A century or two after this took place, there was a spot in Rome where you would abandon your child. And it was perfectly acceptable to do that. In fact, a group of mothers, upon the death of the emperor at the time, in mourning, abandoned their children. And they basically would just take little babies and throw them at this base of the statue, and they'd leave. And that was perfectly acceptable behavior. Now, what was fascinating at the time is the Christian women in Rome would go gather these babies up and take them back home and care for them and raise them. So that early on, the Christians were coming in there and saying, this is terrible. We're gonna rescue these babies. In Rome, you had infanticide. If you didn't want a daughter, you just killed her when she was born. You know, it's similar to the Chinese policy. So you have all this stuff going on, but they seemed to think that the Christians were bad because they killed babies. They didn't, but that was the story there. So you have Jews as well as Christians being viewed as not functioning in the mainstream of society. For Rome, the greatest thing was to keep the peace, and if you don't function within in the mainstream of society, you cause trouble, you upset the peace, you got to get rid of them. From a theological standpoint, this was a time of huge important work in the spread of the gospel. This was a time when the Spirit was so active here on earth. Christ had ascended, you had the Holy Spirit actively involved in the growth of the church. So Satan is going to be involved as well. And at times where you have great spiritual happenings, you're going to have great evil against it. And theologically, we would say that what was happening was Satan was driving these forces to destroy the Christian church at that time. He had worked to destroy the Jews. He was working to destroy Christians. So we have both social reasons as well as theological reasons for these things to take place. Historians aren't going to buy the Satan argument because that's outside the parameters of history. Those of us who read the Bible and believe what it says are going to say, yeah, that's really clear. Satan was using these terrible people to kill this early church, to try to grind it out and stop it. But what you've got is attacks on the church, persecution starting, and it'll ramp up and get really bad. It was made illegal to be a Christian. Okay, so we've got all this going on in the 50s and the 60s. You've got the Zealots now starting to attack Rome down in Jerusalem. The Christian church has removed itself out of Jerusalem to Pella, and ultimately everything just breaks forth, and Rome comes in and destroys Jerusalem. Destroys the temple, destroys Jerusalem. Kills off, I don't know how many Jews. I mean, just destroys them. So now, the church has a problem. You've got no place to go, basically. Those who were Jewish believers, who were still going to the temple and going to synagogue and whatnot, no longer have a temple to go to. The Jews don't have a home to go to either. They've been kicked out of Rome. Jerusalem's been destroyed. The last bastion of the Jews that had escaped to Masada were destroyed. So now you get a handful of rabbis, of a handful of Pharisees who had escaped Jerusalem. And it's interesting, if you read the history, it doesn't bode well for those Pharisees that escaped. It appears, when you read the historical documentation, that they sort of were friendly to Rome and they kind of bought their way out. They knew it was coming and they kind of abandon the joint to go off and hide. Well, however they did, they survived. So now you have a Christian church that's, the book of Acts tells us there were at least 20 different churches that had opened up around the whole Mediterranean area there. You have the Jewish church being moved out of Jerusalem to Pella. Jerusalem is destroyed. Jews are thrown out of Rome. Rome has now come after the Christians and said it's illegal to be a Christian. You know, they're killing them in large amounts. You know, the persecution was so bad that, you know, as you drove down the main road in Rome to the palace, they would all be just crucified on the side of the road there. Terrible persecution. And you have all this upheaval in 70 AD. Okay? The Jews still continue to battle with Rome for another probably 50, 60 years. Finally, I think it's around 140, but some dates placed earlier, around 135. You have what's called the Bar Kokhba Uprising, which was the last sort of zealot uprising against Rome, and Rome just wipes it out. There's wasn't even a fair fight. And so essentially, this is where we get the church. This is where the Christian church is at the death of the last apostle. Okay, so by the time we get to, if we assume that the last apostle, who's John, died in about 90 AD, this is kind of where the church is at that point. You know, it's interesting. There's just all this stuff swirling around, but the church is still functioning, and it's growing rapidly during this time. It's not that people are saying, whoa, I'm not going to go do that. I mean, you know, they just killed 1,000 guys up in Rome. I don't want to be a Christian. Folks are coming, you know, thousands at a time to be Christians, to be part of the church. It is amazing when you see all this stuff going on, the huge rise of the church during the first century. Okay? Again, this is a theological, not a historical argument. It is impossible to understand that with this level of persecution and political unrest and a famine and all this other stuff, there's no way to understand that the church is going to grow that rapidly without divine help. You know, when God said, "I'll protect the church," he really meant it, because the church grew rapidly during this period of time for all this unrest. Next week, we're going to start looking at the first big controversy of the post-apostolic age over how you define the Bible, and we're going to start doing bigger chunks now. We're going to sort of look at from the post-apostolic age, the last death of the last apostle, up to if I'm disciplined enough in my lecture next week, I'll get us up to Nicaea. Which was the first big controversy ending church council after there were other councils before them, but you had the big one, you had the Jerusalem Council, then you have Nicaea. Those are sort of the big landmarks as we go through church history. We'll talk a little bit about the transition from the apostles now to the early, what we call the early church fathers, the folks who came after. And then we get this interesting thing that'll start to occur. We get what's called the apologists. We'll pass the tipping point where the church is no longer predominantly Jewish, it's now predominantly Gentile. And there's an interesting shift that takes place, by the way, theologically when you look through this. The Jewish church, primarily Jewish-based church in the early years of the Christian church, the message was Christ is Messiah and that the kingdom had come. The communion service was about, yes, Messiah has come. This is great. It was a very happy thing. When you start to get more Gentiles than Jews, and we start to move out of the Jewish era into predominantly Gentile era, when it becomes the official church in Rome and all this other stuff, the focus shifts. It's now the focus is on Christ's death, and the death rather than the fulfillment of the messianic promises. It's an interesting little shift that takes place. There's also what I personally, and again, this is my opinion, the seeds of the problems that we have in the church today were sown way back when, in this period of time. The early church apologists, when I still think that when Constantine made the Christian church the official church of Rome, that we were doomed, that you know, Satan couldn't kill everybody off, but he sure could screw it up internally by doing that, because we still bear the scars of that happening. And it was sort of a mixed thing. You got to have that happen for it to survive, but boy, did that just set us up for some terrible stuff. You know, the seeds of the Reformation began with Constantine, and so, you know, but we'll start to see that as we unfold this. But so that's where we're going next week. We'll kind of end this and start looking at the post-apostolic age. Any questions on stuff we covered this evening? Anything? Okay. If you didn't sign the little sheet, please do that so they keep track of everybody that shows up. Remember, just give generously over there in the Pushka box. Bob always has a statement for read the first part of the month, and he didn't give me that, and I feel guilty I didn't, even though I hate reading that statement. So that little spiel we'll cover for having to read that statement. And I'll see everybody here next week. Again, Mike, I put my email on the board last week. If you have questions that of stuff I don't cover in class or anything, please feel free to email me. I'll try to answer stuff that way as well.